Welcome to the TK2D edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the TK2D community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're at the 2025 American Society of Human Genetics Conference in Boston, and our guest is Dr. Sarah Chang, U.S. Medical Strategy Lead for Belgian pharmaceutical company UCB. Dr. Chang is a medical affairs professional focusing on ultra-rare mitochondrial disease called thymidine kinase 2 deficiency, or TK2D. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Hi, Larry. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to specialize in mitochondrial disease.
Thank you for the question. In terms of myself and my background, I actually have a PhD in neurobiology from Columbia University that I received many, many moons ago. And I've spent over 20 years since completing my PhD in the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, focusing on various diseases, some more common than others, but where I really felt my heart was in the area of rare disease. And I have had the great fortune of working for UCB for just over 4 years now and ended up on the thymidine kinase 2 deficiency program, which we actually acquired in, I believe it was 2022 at this point in time, where they have a thymidine kinase 2 deficiency program, and I've been working on it ever since.
Very interesting. And you, in your presentation, spoke a little bit, not too much, about the extreme rarity of the disease. I believe you said it has a frequency, an occurrence of 1.6 per million, which would make it ultra rare, right?
Yeah, it is ultra rare.
To your knowledge, how many patients, both in the United States and worldwide, are diagnosed with this disease?
Thank you. So as of today, in 2025, we know of just over 100 living patients in the United States. When we look more broadly across the globe, what we see is a number probably between 350 and 400 living patients. However, I will caveat that with the fact that this is a likely very underdiagnosed disorder, and so there are more patients out there that we probably don't know about.
And in the United States, out of those 100 living patients, I would assume that all of them are late onset.
Well, I would actually say that about 80% happen to be early onset, and what we've seen are about 20% have the late onset form of the disease. And that could be driven by the fact that the earlier onset form is the more rapidly progressing, it is more severe, and that could precipitate an earlier diagnosis compared with those who have late onset, which tends to be slower progressing. And for those patients in particular, they get kind of punted around the healthcare system without a diagnosis until later on in life.
Well, as you did say, this disease looks a lot like other diseases. And you mentioned spinal muscular atrophy, Pompe disease, and a few others that all have kind of similar symptoms, at least early on. So it makes diagnosing difficult.
Yes.
So doctors are unlikely to think of such a rare disease when they try to figure out what these patients have.
Yeah, it's a great point. It does look like a number of other neuromuscular disorders as well as mitochondrial myopathies. And there are, TK2 deficiency is not the only disease that presents as a primary proximal myopathy. So when a physician sees these patients in the clinic, because it is so rare and because it's unlikely to have been part of their clinical training, they're not thinking TK2D. They're thinking of, even though they're still rare, diseases that are more common, like SMA, for example.
Right. Also, another point is that, well, like you said, it's a long diagnostic odyssey, and it's a relatively new disease. You said the gene was first discovered in 1997, and then the first reported cases were in 2001. Talk a bit about that, if you would. How was it discovered, by who, and where were these patients?
So the gene itself was cloned again in 1997. There is a publication. It came from a group from Northern Europe, I believe Sweden, but don't quote me on that. And from there, you're absolutely right. The first four cases were of young children. They were published in 2001. Then in 2018, the phenotype was described for the first time in the literature, where it broke it down into three distinct phenotypes.
Okay, and can you talk about those three types?
Sure. As we kind of alluded to earlier, there's an early onset of the form of the disease, and that is the most severe, the most rapidly progressing. Within that form, it can be further stratified into two additional subclassifications, 0 to less than or equal to 2 years age of onset, and then 2 to less than or equal to 12 years of onset. The second form is late onset, and that takes place after the age of 12 when patients first present with symptoms.
So those who present after the age of 12 have a median post-onset survival of 23 total.
After symptom onset.
I see.
Which is not necessarily the same thing, because a patient may present with symptoms and then get diagnosed 8 years later.
Right. And then children who present, babies actually before the age of 2, have a median survival of only 1 year.
Yes, it's tragic for those infants. Those are typically your floppy babies. They're hypotonic, and it is very severe.
So I want to talk about what life is like for people with TK2. You mentioned they're in wheelchairs, they have ventilators. You've done surveys and, you know, have come up with some conclusions about quality of life and major burdens both for the patient and caregiver. Can we summarize that?
Sure. So it is a devastating disease. Most of these patients will lose the ability to walk, eat, and breathe independently. It presents, again, as a proximal myopathy. So this is a disease that is a muscle weakness, the muscles closest to the center of the body. What that means for patients is their swallowing muscles, for example, are one thing that's impacted. That could mean that they can't take in food the way someone without this disease can, so they require feeding tube support. The other area that's impacted is the respiratory system. So the diaphragm, for example, your breathing muscles tend to be weaker. This is a disease of energy. When you don't have sufficient muscle strength to breathe, you might end up on a mechanical ventilator or non-invasive support like CPAP or BiPAP. And then many of these patients lose the ability to walk, so they would potentially require a wheelchair or some other walking device. It's devastating all around for not only them, but for their caregivers as well.
Let's talk about that. Since there are so few patients in the world, really, you probably know a lot of these yourself personally, right?
Yes, we have had the great fortune of meeting patients as well as their families, and we've learned a lot from them. Many of them have had to restructure their lives. I can think of a particular family who has a child with TK2 deficiency. They had to get a new car. They had to get a van, in fact, to accommodate the wheelchair, the mechanical ventilator, and the mother, who is the primary caregiver of that child, had to quit her job to focus on full-time caregiving.
So short of a therapy, because right now there aren't any, what can be done to improve the lives of these patients?
So you're correct. There is no FDA-approved therapy at this time. So the focus is really on supportive care. So it's going to be things like getting those wheelchairs, assistive devices, ventilatory support, feeding tube support, making sure that these patients are being managed by the appropriate multidisciplinary care team, because these are complex patients. It's a disease that impacts various organs, different body parts. So they're going to need to be seen by different specialists that will likely include neuromuscular. It could also include gastroenterology, pulmonology, as an example.
Mm-hmm. What about patient advocacy groups? A few of them flashed on the screen briefly. Who's looking out for such people?
So that's a wonderful question. And we would not be where we are today without the support of our patient advocacy partners. The United Mitochondrial Disease Foundation, or the UMDF, is a great example of a patient advocacy group that focuses specifically on mitochondrial disease. They have a large team, and they work not only with patients and caregivers, but also the physician community. So they're bringing together both of those worlds. They have a great set of resources that they can provide to patients or caregivers who are diagnosed with any mitochondrial disease. And they've really created a family around that. They have a conference every year in June. Muscular Dystrophy Association, Mito Action are some other groups that come to mind, as well as NORD. All of these are great organizations that can help connect patients and families with resources.
So MDA also speaks for TK2D?
TK2D, they cover mitochondrial myopathy. So mm-hmm. It fits with, I know that a lot of their focus is on some of the other neuromuscular diseases, but because of the clinical presentation of these mitochondrial myopathies, you will find resources on their website as well.
You mentioned some of the symptoms that early signs of TK2D, and you mentioned the Gower maneuver, mm-hmm. which is also very common with Duchenne muscular dystrophy.
It is, yes.
That's almost a dead giveaway that a boy has Duchenne. When he can't get up off the floor by himself.
It's a great point, and that is just, I think, another testament to the fact that it complicates the differential diagnosis of these patients for physicians.
Mm-hmm. In the short amount of time we have left, any final thoughts on the disease and potential down the line therapies, and also just quality of life care?
So I think in terms of this disease, we're hoping that the future is brighter for people with mitochondrial diseases. There's been a lot of awareness-raising activities that have been conducted in recent years and will continue to conduct in the future. I think the more people know about mitochondrial diseases and TK2D specifically, the more likely these patients are to get to that earlier diagnosis because people will have it on their radar.
Wonderful. We've been speaking with Dr. Sarah Chang, who's U.S. Medical Strategy Lead for UCB. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.